Good morning. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. You're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU 100.1 FM, and I'm very excited to report that we have a very special guest today. Frances Moore LePay wrote her first book, Diet for a Small Planet, in 1971 as a very young woman just out of graduate school, and I well remember when that book came out. It was one of the first cookbooks I ever bought and led me on a path to begin a vegetarian lifestyle. Diet for a Small Planet sold 3 million copies and has been the blueprint for eating with a small carbon footprint since long before the term was coined, according to J.M. Hirsch of the Associated Press. In 2008, Diet for a Small Planet was selected of one of 75 books by women whose words have changed the world by members of the Women's National Book Association in observance of its 75th anniversary. Frances was named by Gourmet Magazine as one of 25 people, including Thomas Jefferson, Upton Sinclair, and Julia Child, whose work has changed the way America eats. Since 1971, Frances has written 17 additional books and co-founded three organizations, including Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. More recently, she and her daughter Anna founded the Small Planet Institute, a collaborative network for research and popular education. Frances and her daughter have also co-founded the Small Planet Fund. Frances has received many awards from many different countries. In 1987, she received the Right Livelihood Award for revealing the political and economic causes of world hunger and how citizens can help to remedy them. Frances's books have been translated into 15 languages and are used widely in university courses. She's received 18 honorary doctorates from distinguished institutions. In 2008, she received the James Beard Foundation Humanitarian of the Year Award for her lifelong impact on the way people all over the world think about food, nutrition, and agriculture. Frances has taught in institutions all over the globe and in 2007 became a founding member of the World Future Council based in Hamburg, Germany. Her most recent work, and the one we're here today to discuss, is EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. It was released by Nation Books in September 2011. Welcome to the show, Frances.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted and looking forward to being there in your state very soon.
Yeah, I believe you're going to be traveling later today and you'll arrive in Iowa tomorrow. Will you be coming first to Iowa City? Is that right?
Yes. I'll speak there at the university tomorrow night. And on our website at smallplanet.org, you can see all of our events. But the first one for this week is tomorrow night.
And so you'll also be in Des Moines and in Ames, Iowa. So people who are interested in reading and in meeting Frances can do so either in Iowa City or Ames or Des Moines this week, which is pretty exciting. So tell us a little bit about the difference between a possibilist and an optimist and why you are a possibilist and what that means.
Well, what it means is that if we really develop the eco-mind, which is the new book, right? It's how do we think like an ecosystem in which we're not just sort of separate little entities and entities and kind of a static condition, but the reality of life is connection. We're all linked and everything is in continuous change. So if that's true, then I love to say it's not possible to know what's possible in such a world. And while certainly the trend lines don't look that positive, but change is the given, and we have to be ready for surprises, and so much depends, I argue in this book, EcoMind, so much depends on how we define the problem if we're going to get to the solutions. So that's why I call myself not an optimist, not a pessimist, because that pretends that we can predict the future, but a possibilist, because I believe that it is certainly possible that we can make a very big planetary shift toward more life-enhancing economies and societies.
And it seems as though in this book you're arguing that if we change the way we think, then we can change the world, and that we have certain thoughts that are holding us back. So would you explain what some of those thoughts are and how we can change them?
Well, let me just say that this is not some woo-woo, new-agey, you know, idea. That the fact that human beings create the world according to the ideas that we hold, the beliefs that we hold, is pretty widely documented. And the idea that, you know, we see through a certain frame and that we can't see outside that frame. So that's what I mean when I'm talking about shifting our thoughts. It's really shifting the framing of how we define the problem. Because as we know in anything in life, you know, if we don't get our questions right, we're not going to get the solutions. So what I mean by that, for example, there are 7 thought traps around which the book is organized. And the first one is the idea that we've hit the limits of a finite planet and that the real problem is an absolute quantitative boundary that we've hit. I think that's a very unhelpful way of looking at our problem. For one, that it doesn't get us curious about what are the systems of waste and destruction that we are currently creating and participating in every day, because we think, oh, the problem's out there, it's that nature is skimpy, and even leads us to think, oh, we have to do better than nature, you know, we have to try geoengineering and genetically modified seeds, etc. So that is not a very helpful way of looking at it. And So I'm arguing really that we have created systems that are malaligned, badly aligned, even perversely aligned with nature, including our own nature. And that's what is causing the great suffering and the experience of scarcity amid potential plenty and, in many cases, actual plenty. So I'm trying to shift my own thinking from just a quantitative more or less to an understanding that is more ecological, which is that everything is connected and in systems that are co-created, and really we have to look at what is the cause of the enormous waste and destruction and deprivation that is happening, not because we've hit some absolute limit, but because of the rules and the assumptions that we hold.
Well, one of the things I have to ask you, because you've been working to combat world hunger, it looks like for over 40 years.
That's right.
And so there must be something in you that enables you to keep, like, fighting this fight, and despite things that, you know, could seem very discouraging. So there's something about your thought processes that I think is very inspiring to other people. And I'm wondering, like, what is it that keeps you, like, what is it that gives you hope and keeps you going?
Well, you're right. Just laying out the facts for people is important, I think. So I'll start out by saying that we are creating significantly more food today for each person on Earth than when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, that came out exactly 40 years ago. We are producing significantly more food for each of us, and yet we have more hunger than we did then, more hunger than ever in human history. So, from one point of view, oh my gosh, I've been saying all this, that there's enough food for all, and hunger is worse. So I think what gets me up in the morning is the realization of how much more we know about what does work than we did 40 years ago, and so many examples of the creation of thriving communities. And those are the stories that I tell in my talk that I will be telling tomorrow night and my other 2 stops in Iowa. That, for example, in terms of, we know now that we can grow food in a way that is aligned with nature rather than over disrupting natural regenerative power of the earth to sustain itself. We know that we can do that, and there's a whole field now of agroecology that was just barely known 40 years ago, that it was just beginning. And now studies show that if the entire world went in this direction toward agroecological farming, that we could produce more than we do now and enough to feed future population. But the key to this whole agroecological approach, it really potentially can make the farmer much more independent, much more empowered, much more trusting of his, her own knowledge and sharing with neighbors, as is happening in parts of Africa and Asia that I've been looking at. So that it's not just whether agroecological approaches produce enough food, which they do, but who is empowered then to actually have access to that food versus being made dependent upon purchased inputs that can put people in such debt that they can't even afford to buy the basics. So it's really a transformational way of relating to the earth that keeps me in my possiblest state, because there is just so many examples around the world now of how this works.
Could you give us one of those examples?
Well, I'll give you two from different parts of the world. One of them is, I love this because it is a country now that is facing a lot of famine in parts of the country. It's Niger, which is just below, you know, the northern, it's a first tier of the sub-Saharan African countries. And in 2010, there was tremendous hunger there as well. And yet, in this very same country, which is one of the poorest in the entire world, in fact, it ranked lowest not very long ago, there, over 20 years, farmers have been re-greening the land, meaning that they've been nurturing the regrowth of trees before they cut because they thought they were interfering with the crops instead of helping. And they also were intimidated by the colonial government and felt that they would get into trouble. That's a longer story, but the point is that there were cultural reasons that they were cutting the forest, the trees down, and they started nurturing them and integrating them with their growing of crops. And the trees helped make sure that the soil was stable and didn't blow away, because this is some parts of Niger are almost desert now. And so over time, the soil was much more fertile. These trees actually allowed the roots, enabled more water retention. And over time, the yields increased, and they also were able to, the people there nurturing the trees were able to use the leaves and the fruits from the trees for fodder, for fuel, for fruits from the trees to eat, etc. So, bottom line is that over 20 years, now 12.5 million acres of land have been restored that were just so hard-packed and so desert-like that they weren't growing food much. And as well, people have been then able to stabilize 2.5 million people in food security and feeling that they do have enough. And people are returning to the villages there who had given up, and it's quite an amazing story. Mm-hmm. And yet, most of us have never heard of it, right?
Well, no, yeah, I've certainly never heard of it. And I'm wondering, like, what instigated this change? Like, why did the people stop cutting down the trees? Like, what caused
it? Was a shift in perception back to that whole theme, because the colonial government, the French government, had told people that the trees belonged to the state, and that if they harmed the trees, then they would be in big trouble with the government. And the response of the small farmer was just to cut the tree, you know, just to make them disappear so they wouldn't have to be worried about what the government would do to them. And also, they perceived the tree in competition to the crops. So there was two kinds of shift in perception. And yet, they had a more ancient knowledge of the fact that trees and crops could be compatible and actually synergistic. And also, there were NGOs who were helping as well. But it was very much a peasant movement. So that began with this shift in perception, and then it was that there was a broad sharing of this new knowledge and new approach, so that it became something that was acceptable. So I just think that, you know, so much is that we start doing things a certain way. That's what we human beings do, and often don't then wait. Why are we doing this? Why are we getting rid of the trees? They might be helpful. So this is, but this whole field of agroforestry, the actual combination of trees and crops, is really taking off now. And in fact, the World Agroforestry Center, which is part of the UN, connected to the UN, it's based in Africa, and they estimate that agroforestry itself, if we really took that approach to the max of what its potential could be, that we could actually deal with about a third of the excess carbon in the atmosphere that is causing our climate disruption. So it's a huge factor, and this Niger story is just so powerful because it is among the poorest people in the world, and I love I read a story about a village chief there who simply said, "We stopped the desert and everything changed." And he then described the return of the young men to the villages. But I asked the Dutchman the scientist who had told me about this and who keeps me up to date about it because he travels there often. And I said, "Chris, why didn't anyone know about this?" And he said, "Frankie, nobody thought to look." In other words, again, it's a matter of perception. If we don't expect to see something, that people were just not looking at the satellite images and seeing this great, you know, regrowth happening. And I think that's pretty interesting too.
And I think you were going to also tell us a second example.
Well, a second one is, I love it for, you know, it's a beautiful story. I was joking recently with a friend of mine. I said, I never thought I'd tear up over a World Bank report, but this report gave more information about something I've been following in India. And in Andhra Pradesh, which is a large state in sort of central India, I'm trying to visualize it. Anyway, I haven't been there. I've just been reading about this for years and in touch with people there, and I want to go visit. But there, people were desperate from indebtedness, people meaning the small farmers. And this is this area that I was particularly looking at, called the Deccan Plateau. It's dry land. There's no irrigation. And so they, some of them had tried genetically modified cotton, hoping that would help, and it failed, and there was there have been just plagued by suicides and from people who were so indebted they saw no way out. And so gradually a women-led movement has gotten underway that is moving toward, well, they call it the non-pesticide movement. It's also been called community-supported sustainable agriculture, I think is the other term they use. But encouraging people and organizing villages, village by village, to stop using chemicals, which are so expensive. The fertilizers and pesticides there cost, the total cost adds up to almost half of their overall, you know, what they, the price they, I mean, the returns they get from selling. So it's a huge portion of their potential income is then they have to spend out again to buy the inputs. So they started moving themselves toward organic approaches, which didn't require those expensive inputs, and moving toward the use of and the sharing of indigenous seeds. And over time, this has spread now. Last time I looked at it, it was like 3,000 villages. And people's health is improving. A local economy is improving because people are making the indigenous, you know, sort of, I call them the potions to prevent pest infestation, that are using local ingredients, chilies and the neem tree and all sorts of things. And so they have sort of little cottage industries there of their own natural pest control potions. And and people say the food tastes better too. So this is and the state is now behind it. The state government is now supporting this approach. So it started in, you know, a few villages, and now is reaching thousands, and the state government is working with this movement. So it's quite impressive. People actually in the villages are asked to sign a pledge that they will not use chemicals, and then those who sign that pledge, then their neighbors hold them accountable because they want the whole village to go in that direction, so that nobody's crops will be affected by the chemicals.
I want to just remind listeners, you're listening to Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson at KRUU 100.1 FM. We're a solar-powered community radio station. Our guest today is Frances Moore LePay, author of Diet for a Small Planet and 17 other books, including her recently released in September 2011 book, Eco-Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. So would you tell us a little bit more about some of the principles in your book and how we need to change some, or I guess dispel some myths that we're all kind of, we've bought into?
Well, I'll mention another. There, as I say, there's seven thought traps and seven thought leaps in the book. That's how it's organized. And so I'll mention a couple more. One is the thought trap that human beings are, in essence, you know, if you strip away the extra fluff around us and get down to, you know, who we really are, we are selfish, we are competitive, we are materialistic, and that better, you know, for better or worse, excuse me, for better or worse, that's what we've got to count on. And so we just have to sort of overcome that in some way if we're going to make the world a better place.
Overcome the thought or overcome the fact that that's who we really are?
All this core of our negativity. And you hear a lot of people calling for this transformation of the human spirit and changing, you know, our way in that sense. What I'm arguing, for example, E.O. Wilson, I'm sure you know that name, the biologist, such a remarkable and admirable person I really admire. But he often uses the phrase, you know, we have to overcome our Stone Age emotions, that idea that somehow we're lacking and we've got to overcome these negatives. And my take is quite different in the sense that there is now a revolution in understanding human nature, partly because of new breakthroughs in anthropology and archaeology, but also because of neuroscience, looking at our brains with the MRI scans and seeing sort of what is happening there when we experience things. So I tell in the book, I tell about an experiment in which they looked at our brains while we're competing and when we're cooperating, and it turns out when we cooperate that our brains light up as if we were eating chocolate. So they have a lot to, we're learning a lot about how profoundly social we are, how naturally empathetic we are, and how much we love cooperation. So my thesis in that chapter and in the book and the eco-mind concept is that it's really not about changing our nature or overcoming it in that sense. It's about creating societies and the rules from our homes to our cities and our nations and our world that bring out those positive pro-social qualities and keep the negatives, which we know are also there, and I delve into those too, but, you know, keep them in check. And what are the conditions, just like you would think of your house plant, right? What are the conditions that are going to bring out the best in it? Does it need more or less sunlight? Does it need more or less water? On and on. So the same with human beings. What are the conditions that bring out the best, and what are the conditions that bring out the worst? So it's not about changing our nature. It's about understanding our nature and then using our smarts to bring out the best. And so I identify throughout the book three conditions that I think are proven to bring out the best, and in the reverse, which sadly is what we're creating, they bring out the worst. And those are the concentration of power brings out the worst, secrecy brings out the worst, and cultures of blame, where we're just pointing fingers at one another, that brings out the worst in us. And the opposite of those, the continuous dispersion of power, transparency in human relations, and a culture of mutual responsibility. So I'm stepping up, you're stepping up by creating the radio station that you've created. You're an example. You're not just pointing fingers at negative media. You're creating alternative. So that is really the frame. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but it is to me a very big shift from somehow we've got to change human nature in some way, or somehow.
Yeah, which sounds like, you know, well, that's the impossible task, and so you can
see why it's the impossible task, and yet we know the dramatic differences, say in murder rates or in, you know, all sorts of negative human behaviors are radically different culture by culture. Well, that's not because human nature is different, right? It's because of the rules and norms that we human beings are creating. And unfortunately, and this is the great tragedy of my adult life, is that I'm living in a country that is moving fast in the direction of creating those three conditions that bring out the worst in us.
And yet you still seem full of this awareness of possibilities.
I'm sorry.
You still seem aware of the possibilities of, you know, you still sound very hopeful and don't seem to be in despair. So you must be holding possibilities of better things in your mind.
To me, I guess, Cheryl, the thing is, for me, I don't know if it's for you, it's like this, but if I feel totally confused and totally overwhelmed, then I am the first person to feel despair. And but if I feel like I have some framework of understanding, some causal theory, and that gives me a sense of what I'm supposed to do the next day, then even if things are really bad, I don't get depressed. In other words, the last chapter of the book is called It's Too Late, that idea that, you know, that's the last thought trap, it's too late. And I challenge that and say that, you know, it's not a big challenge that makes people depressed and paralyzes us. It's only when we can't see how that problem got created so we know what to do about it, you know, whether it's about a behavior problem in our child or, you know, the food supplies poisoning us. You know, it's if we have no clue, then we're just in fear and despair. If we have a theory that we're working on, not a dogmatic one, but one we're continuing to you know, shine the light on and bring new evidence for or against, then we can feel our power. So the book is really about power. It's about how we find our power, because it starts by my saying that I walked out of a conference a few years ago on global problems feeling absolutely paralyzed. And so not the person that you're talking to now, but I felt very different, you know, because I just felt an overwhelm, because that conference wasn't supplying me, helping me to keep my eyes on the prize of that understanding of why. And therefore, if I can get a glimpse of why, then I know what to do. So I say in the book that eco-mind means being the two-year-old, you know, always asking why.
Well, I do want to remind listeners you're going to be in Iowa soon, and so you'll be here tomorrow, and we appreciate you taking time out of your schedule today when you're getting ready for a trip. But you'll be in Iowa City tomorrow, and I believe Des Moines and Ames in the next couple days after that. And if people want details on those of your visits here, they can go to your website, which is Small Planet. Is that right?
Smallplanet.org, and you'll see the tab there, Events. You just click on that, and you'll see that list of Iowa events, and it gives you exactly where I'm going, you know, even a map, you know, if you don't know where the hall is that I'll be in.
So
you can always, if there's any question, just email info@smallplanet.org, and our team will shoot right back to you and answer exactly anything that's not clear to you.
So, and also, we're listening to Frances Moore Lappe talk about her work combating world hunger and trying to foster better conditions for everyone on the planet. And it sounds like a big part of the solution is just people having information. And so you and your daughter have created a foundation that's sort of in the business of disseminating information. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, again, information, it's not just data points, of course. It's what is the framework of meaning, and that is our goal. My daughter is a brilliant writer, and she's now, we wrote one book together, which was the delight of my life, called Hope's Edge, where we traveled the world, and that's where I learned about so many of these stories of possibility that I call them. And so that's Hope's Edge, and then she's written a book called Grub, which is starts with a summary of what it's one of the best I've ever seen, of really summarizing what are the main myths and problems in our food system, and then has wonderful recipes that you can make with your friends. It's really a wonderful book. And then she wrote a book entitled Diet for a Hot Planet. So she's looking at food and climate change very deeply in that book. So we write books. As you said in the intro, I'm still at that enterprise, and I think five in this last decade, and everything from this current book, Eco Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want, to a very related book about fear called You Have the Power, Choosing Courage in a Culture of Fear. So it's very broad-reaching, the kind of education that we're offering. And I'm also developing a workshop based on EcoMind, so it's not just lectures. It's also the deeper level of workshops and articles and blogs and interviews. So it's very, very rewarding work.
So have you been plunging yourself into all this media personally? Or it looks like your son does some of that work as well.
Yeah, I work with, wow, what a blessing. Yeah, both of my children. Yeah, he's a videographer, and he's made numerous videos for us. And I also have written something recently with him that got more. It's amazing. He and I wrote something a couple weeks ago that has gotten more play on Facebook and Twitter and everything than anything I've ever written. It's called Don't Think of a Pig, Why Corporate Greed is the Wrong Frame. And this is about the Occupy movement. But it just went crazy with people commenting and sharing it, so we were very gratified. So, yeah, I even write with my son and my daughter now, I can say. And he's also a great writer, and he is also a videographer who runs a little company he created called Invisible Hand Media that does videos for social benefit organizations.
Well, it interests me that both your children have followed in your footsteps. A lot of times when people are as active as you are, they sometimes aren't able to foster those close connections. And I'm wondering what your home life was like that you created these two, sounds like really wonderful now, adults who, you know, are also fabulous writers and communicators. Like, what was your life like when you were creating all these books and traveling? And
it's hard even to know how to capture that. I was divorced when my children were quite young, when they were just really, Anna was not even three yet, so, you know, very young. I had shared custody. So that meant that whenever I had them, the half time that I had them, I didn't do anything else. You know, that was like, I never got a babysitter. You know, it was just like totally, totally us. And I also took them places with me. I was just thinking last night that it was, my son was just six, my daughter three, when I took them with me to Guatemala for a chunk of a summer, and it was life-changing for all of us. And that was where my son first had his first sociological insight at 6 years old about unfairness. And we were up on a hillside above Antigua, Guatemala, and he looked down and said, "Oh, look at those really big farms, Mommy. Look at those really big farms. But the people on the way to school this morning, they didn't have any land at all. How come some people have so much land and some people don't have any?" So I think that I took my daughter with me to a farm labor camp when she was 11, and we toured the camp, and that had a lasting impact on her. So I think, you know, including them in my work was part of our lives, and you know, we just always were very close, and I'm just so blessed now by the relationship.
It sounds like a wonderful life to be doing the work you're doing with, you know, with your children as adults. That's incredible.
Yeah, it is. This trip, as I said, that Anna and I took was the life-changing one for both of us, and it was, you know, because we just set out on this journey, ended up five continents, not knowing very much ahead of time of what the story would be that we would uncover. And we found people who were at just two of them, by the way, have since won Nobel Peace Prizes, people that we profile in the book. But at the time, we had no idea of what we were going to uncover. And we were so profoundly moved, inspired, empowered by what we learned. So I think that was one of the best decisions I ever made. But, of course, that came from their own advice to me. You know, I followed their advice to write that book. That was my children's idea. They said, "This is what you've got to do, and we'll help you do it." So,
wait. Which book was that?
It's called Hope's Edge. Hope's Edge.
I'm wondering if you cooked with your children, too. Are they great cooks?
My daughter is. My daughter is. My son's wife is such a great cook that I don't think he bothers. But I can't say we did a lot of cooking together, but some, I would say some, and certainly they ate the Small Planet diet and are both really healthy as a result. But my daughter, you know, she actually she's quite the chef. So,
well, I have to tell you, the three recipes that I remember using the most, you know, that still linger in my mind are like garden vegetable pie. I remember I used to make that for company a lot from Diet for a Small Planet, and enchilada bake, and there was a fruit pancake recipe in there that my husband used to always make. And one of the things I recall from using Diet for a Small Planet, which was your first book, of course, was cooking things with my son. And he's grown up to be this fabulous cook that now, you know, I learn a lot about cooking from him.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and I think that that's sort of like part of your message, is that making little changes in your life, like you probably have no idea, I mean, you don't know me or my son, but we both were influenced by your first book.
And, oh, that makes me very happy.
And I think the more that you, you know, just make little changes in people's behavior just by disseminating information, so just by having that cookbook, it's really affected, you know, a lot of how we live.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe I'm being presumptuous, but for me, I was looking at the first edition of Diet for a Small Planet not long ago and realizing that there I emphasized that, you know, from the very first when I started learning about food, and I said, oh my gosh, this is fabulous, because I don't have to be a victim of advertising, a victim of somebody else telling me for their own interest what to do. I can actually empower myself through my knowledge. I can choose what's best for me, best for the earth, best for others. And it was just this sense of liberation. You know, it wasn't a duty or a burden. It was a liberation. And I think, and then that, once you feel that kind of power, excuse me, in one area of one's life, I think that bleeds over, you know, in a positive way to other things. Who knows? You know, maybe your initiative in creating this and being part of this radio, maybe this is really presumptuous of me, but you know, once you start taking power in one part of your life, and I think it can make us feel that we can do other things as well.
I think that's probably absolutely true. And I'd have to say, you know, it's just my interest in books and writers that has led me to volunteer to be a host when the regular host, Monica Hadley, is not here. And as a result, like, I've gotten to speak to people like you and some very famous writers. And it's astounding to me. I can be in this very tiny nonprofit radio station in Fairfield, Iowa, and get to speak to a globetrotter, like, political activist person like you who's so knowledgeable. And we don't know how many people are listening and how many people will want to go and read your new book, which is Eco Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. But it's little ripples. So I guess that's what it is to be a possibilist.
Exactly. Exactly. And so far, and you know, as you say, you never know who's listening. And the other night I was in Oregon at the big Powell's bookstore.
Oh, I love that bookstore. My son lived in Portland for a while.
It was incredible. And so I was sitting there signing books, and a man approached me and he said, would you sign this for my 12-year-old son, because he really loved your talk. So you never know, you know, that 12-year-old, who knows what effect it's going to have on him.
Right, and it's really, it is hard to tell. So let's see, why don't you tell us one of the other myths that people are holding on to that it would be better if we could let go of. So I like the one about greed. Oh, one thing I wanted to ask also was, you said to not think of the pig, like that was a slogan that really took off.
I'll explain that allusion. That's from George Lakoff's book, Don't Think of an Elephant, and his book is all about the frame. And so Anthony picked that title. My son Anthony picked that title, Don't Think of a Pig, because we're arguing that focusing on corporate greed is the wrong definition of the problem. As I was saying earlier, it's not because people on Wall Street started out any greedier than the rest of us. It's that we allowed the rules to be created so that they could operate in secrecy and basically take enormous risks with other people's money. So that was what that was about. Don't think of a pig. We just were trying to think of something catchy, and it seemed to have worked.
That answers a question I've, like, just turned over in my mind, because I keep thinking, like, where did these people come from? Because I think about, you know, like, when they were children, were they money-grubbing? Or, you know, like, did they feel like they needed to have so much money? And now it's helping me to understand a little better. You're just saying what the conditions are, you know, that we all have good tendencies and bad tendencies, but some of these bad tendencies can come out if we don't watch out to avoid these certain conditions.
And I was very moved on this point by listening a year or so ago to an interview with a man that I quote in the book, Mike Francis, if I remember his name right. And he sounded like your guy next door, sweet guy. And he said, you know, these loans that they were writing, he said, we called them liar's loans because we actually encouraged people to lie to us so that we could write the loan. And he said, I knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong, but everybody else was doing it. And I think, you know, even if we think we're not vulnerable to that kind of logic, I don't think any of us know until we're tested, because we are so influenced by group pressure. And so that's why I end the book focused on courage. But I wanted to go back to another thought trap in the book, thought trap and thought leap. And I'm mentioning this one because a couple people recently have told me it's their favorite chapter. And I was kind of surprised. But it's a chapter that the thought trap is that human beings hate rules, and that therefore to solve the planet's problems, we have to force, you know, stuff this down people's throats. They're going to have to accept more restrictions, more restrictive regulations on their lives. And so the thought leap for me in that is that actually humans love rules. The rules give shape and meaning and sense of connection with others, and that nothing, of course, could function without rules, whether it's a sports game or a drive to, you know, down the street. I mean, obviously, our life and all of nature involves rules. So I argue that the problem is only when people feel disrespected in the creation of the world, so they don't feel their voices are heard, and when they feel that they are disadvantaged and hurt by them. And so I talk in the book about every, you know, obvious things like marriage vows and the Ten Commandments and all the things that we try to live by and give our lives meaning. But I also counter that idea that we hate rules with the fact that rules can take off, new rules can take off very quickly and have enormous impact if they do make sense to people and people feel respected in them. And so I give, for example, in Germany is a rule, that is a legislative framework, that rewards any household for installing clean energy, like a solar panel or a small wind generator. And they're rewarded by a price for the energy that they generate that's enough to enable them to recoup their investment and to profit. And so they then become contributors. And now 80% of the installations in renewable energy in Germany are from households. And it's a win-win for everyone. And now Germany, in less than 10 years, is going to have about 40% of its electricity generated by clean energy generators. So this is the kind of thing that just took off so fast in Germany, and now is in about, it's so logical and makes sense to people. They feel included in it. They're not just passive recipients, but they're generators of energy. They're being fairly treated for what they do. And so now about 60 countries, provinces, and states are using this. And so it's what I call a wildfire of common sense, quoting a supervisor in San Francisco where they passed a plastic bag ban in certain places, and it just took off, and he called it a wildfire of common sense. And so that's one of the themes of that chapter. There are many more.
I want to remind listeners, do a station identification, but while I'm doing that, I was wondering if you might find a short passage from the book that you could read to us.
Oh, wow. I have it right here. I hadn't thought. I haven't done that before.
Okay, and while you're finding that, this is KRUU 100.1 FM. You're listening to Cheryl Fusco Johnson, pinch hitting for Monica Hadley, the regular host. And with me today is Frances Moore LePay, who's written 18 books. Diet for a Small Planet was the first. And she's going to now read from us a little excerpt from Eco Mind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. So go ahead and share a few
Well,
passages.
I'll just start from the very beginning here, why I wrote this book, which begins. A few years ago, I was asked to speak in Washington, D.C. at a big conference on the global environmental crisis. A lot of my heroes would be presenting. A lot of speakers in just a couple of days. Wow, I thought, this is bound to be just the crash course I need to make me more effective in addressing the problems I care most about. How convenient. I did learn a huge amount in those days, but as I walked out of the auditorium after the final speaker, something hit me. Actually, I felt something had just hit me. I felt numb and heavy, very heavy. Reflecting on that experience, I noted that as the conference had worn on, the audience had worn down. And so then I go on to explain, you know, that initial reaction and how that motivated me to try a very different way of understanding. I said, arriving home after the conference, I was deeply troubled and asked myself, are we environmentalists actually defeating our own ends just when the magnitude of our environmental crisis is becoming clearer by the day? Are we pushing people to despair? This question seized me. I believe that human beings are by nature doers. Most of us love to solve problems. Without that core trait, our species could never have created our complex societies. Forget the wheel, forget the steam engine, forget decoding the human genome. But over decades, I've also come to appreciate that that central to our ability to solve a problem is how we perceive the challenge, how we frame it. That seeing determines our capacity for doing, and certainly for effective doing. So I ask myself, is there a way of perceiving the environmental challenge that is at once hard-headed, evidence-based, and invigorating, one that welcomes us to become engaged problem solvers? Might it be possible to transform something that can feel so frightening as to make us go numb into a challenge so compelling that billions of us will eagerly embrace it? And that really was the beginning of the book. And I did this book in a crowdsourced way, meaning that I put out a draft and asked people, should I go forward with this and what are your ideas for it? And that was a marvelous experience. I got the equivalent of about 60 single-space pages of feedback.
So you did that online?
Yes, in part, yeah.
Well, that's really interesting.
Well, it was actually a little book that was a draft that I didn't sell in bookstores or any official channels, but just made available to people.
Well, I want you to have time to get ready for your trip because I understand you're coming to Iowa soon, so our time has just about come to an end. Do you have any last thought for people? But let me first tell them that you're Frances Moore LePay, and you're going to be speaking in Iowa City tomorrow, November 1st, and you'll also have visits in Des Moines and Ames, and people can find that information on your website, smallplanet.org. So any final short thought?
Oh, as you now know, if you've heard this, what I've been saying, that I believe that we create the world according to the ideas we hold, and so much of what we hear is so negative and so, I believe, falsely framed in the sense that it's not really aligned with nature, with what we know about ecology. So my final thought is that one of the things that we can make a vow to do right now is to bring stories of possibility, I call them, you know, bring stories of the breakthroughs that are more aligned with our nature and with human nature, and seek those out. And I, for example, Yes Magazine, Solutions Journal, our website, we have all sorts of articles that Anna and I have written and other sources we recommend. And just want to underscore that all of my books are full of stories of possibility, and certainly this new one. It's not just a theoretical book about how we think. It is examples and some very surprising facts about what is possible and what is happening. So
Well, thank you. I think we need to let you go pack and get ready for your trip to come to Iowa, but I really appreciate your sharing your thoughts with us and taking the time out of your day. It's been very inspiring to speak with you.
Well, you're very kind, Cheryl. Thank you so much, and thank you for being part of the station, too.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.